This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Hezril, and we are going to be continuing our look back on the year today. Our focus is going to be on how 2020 has fared when it comes to the progress of human rights. And as with everything else, COVID-19 has played a huge part in charting the course this year. And the repercussions have really been quite devastating.
Yeah, and the pandemic has highlighted the severity of certain human rights violations and how there's an urgent need to reform policies and protections for marginalized communities. A glaring example that we've seen, of course, is the various clusters in factories and construction sites across the country, right? We clearly see now how the violations and gaps in protection have endangered the lives of the migrant and foreign worker communities.
Yes, and we're going to be diving into that in a little bit more detail later on. But for now, let's go back to when the outbreak first began. The immediate fears on the ground were more related to issues surrounding mobility and the loss of income. Here's a conversation that you, Hez, and Kelvin actually had with Heidi Kwa, founder and director at Refuge for the Refugees, on the second day of the first movement control order.
I think there's currently a lot of fear among the refugee communities in regards to COVID-19 and particularly the movement restriction order. You know, the sentiments I get from speaking to the refugee community themselves, they tell us that they are so dependent on just surviving through the month that with this happening at the moment, the fear would be, what would rent look like next month? How would we survive with daily necessities? Will we be able to, you know, provide food for our family? Will we be able to cover for electricity bills? And I think a big question mark would also be their access to food, right? You know, we see so many shelves being wiped clean over the past couple of days. And I know while, you know, it's constantly being restocked and that's great, these communities, you know, they don't have as much access to food as we do. Another concern would be immunity. Refugees and migrant communities often stay in overcrowded places, right? I talk to my kids and sometimes they have up to 15 people staying in a really cramped up low-cost flat. And often it goes to the extent of them having to take turns to sleep at night because rent is so expensive and they earn so little. So they stay in very overcrowded communities with lack of access to proper sanitization. And then we look at their mental health, you know, how they're currently processing the situation. I think the struggle would really be that while they have already gone through so much and Malaysia, it's really just a stopover for them in that sense before waiting to be resettled to another country. The concern would be, what does it mean when we have 15 people at home at the same time? How would they manage with all of this? You know, how are they processing this information? Are they getting enough information? There's obviously a lot of fear among the public in general, but especially within the refugee community, right? Because there's that fear of, you know, if I walk out the bicycle, will I get arrested and detained? You know, how do I fork out enough money to pay for healthcare? And then there is that whole safety and security aspect as well, fear of arrest, fear of detention. For example, now that the roads are clearer and, you know, the army is out, the police are out, you know, making sure that the public stays home as much as possible. And I think that's great. For a refugee community to walk out now, they would obviously feel extremely fearful because of the possible arrest and detention that's happening.
Right. And with the whole picture that you gave us, how does this then affect refugees' ability to be able to access healthcare services? That includes testing and treatment as well.
Yeah, so I think that would really, again, it's a lot of fear that's being instilled, right? I think, first of all, they don't have as much access to information as we do. So the question therein lies, you know, with all the information that's pushed out to the public for us to know, how is it being translated to the refugee communities? Is it being translated to a language that they understand? Is it being communicated clearly that, like, you can step forward? I mean, yes, while MOH is saying that, like, hey, step forward and we won't arrest and detain you, but obviously linking back to your past experiences, that is still that massive fear that, is this true? Will I step forward and be detained anyway?
Yeah.
And that would be the main struggle when it comes to the refugee community. And because so much, like, for people like me, you know, I can make sure that I've got enough to get through for the next 2 weeks. But for the refugee community, I can't quite say the same because they lack access in terms of finances.
Yeah, and I guess part of the work that you do is being able to be on the ground to speak with and work with refugee and migrant communities directly. But now with the advice being that social distancing is the status quo, is the thing that you should practice, how does that get in the way of your work? Or, you know, how have you found ways to navigate around this whole idea of social distancing?
Yeah, so I think you pointed out a really good fact, right? A lot of our work, it's really person to person, especially because of the massive language barrier. So a lot of times, you know, if you, a lot of times face-to-face conversations are a lot more effective compared to phone calls and online conversations. So that has been quite difficult to navigate as well. We have, as much as possible, try to connect with the community online. But this is also understanding that maybe 50% of them do not have access to technology or Wi-Fi or, you know, money to pay for internet access on your phone. So that has been really hard for us. We've worked around by tapping into community leaders. So what helps for us is that we are very much in touch with the major community leaders. So we go through them, pass information while receiving information as well, and use that to trickle down to the communities.
The health minister has said that the government is seeking to work with NGOs to tackle the situation. Do you know how that has worked out so far?
Honestly, we've not gotten much on our end. So while the Ministry of Health has taken the right step in issuing a circular stating that all foreigners with symptoms will be exempted from foreigners' fees and receive tests with all positive cases to receive treatment for free regardless of nationality, I think this information is not widely communicated to refugee and migrant communities as yet. So they are still under the understanding that that when they step forward, it's going to be really expensive. Just to give you, just to help people understand a bit more, well, as Malaysian citizens have access to outpatient services like public hospitals for a very minimal fee, foreigners pay at least 15 times that rate. So you pay 15 times that rate, and then you also risk your safety in terms of detention and arrest. So I think this information about you know, foreigners being exempted to receive tests, it's being exempted from foreigners' fees has not been communicated clearly yet. So I think as an NGO or as an activist, you know, the common agreement among all of us is that testing and treatment for COVID-19 must remain free for all citizens and foreigners, regardless of their legal status. And that's something that we are truly trying to advocate for, getting people, making sure that, you know, that this information is known to people and it's widely circulated in their native languages, you know, within the refugee and migrant communities.
Okay, and I guess just on that note, on two ends, you know, what kind of supports do refugee communities need the most in this time? And for you personally, what kind of support would you like to see?
I think the major support would be funding. A lot of them are really struggling with their rent to get through the next month. So we're trying to set up a fund for those that are struggling with their rent, just so that they can tide over for the next month till they get back to jobs. I think so that would be number one, funding. Number two would be provisions for the family in terms of, you know, hand sanitizers. So access to clean water within the community. I think what would be great is we can actually set up tanks of clean water for refugees to access, just so that they can improve on their sanitization at this point of time. And provisions as well in terms of dry food, you know, whether it's simple stuff like bags of rice, tin fish, this would all be really helpful for the community. Some people have been stepping forward, you know, asking, hey, can I send packs of cooked food? Can I take away from a restaurant and send it to the refugee community? And while that is great and really helpful, we also want to be very careful to avoid food wastage. because packed food and cooked food can only last for a number of hours before it goes bad. So we are thinking that if we can get access to provisions like bags of rice, you know, canned food, milk, for the refugee community, this would be really helpful. I think one thing that we are trying to do as well is improve on their nutrition at this point of time, because everyone's immunity is impacted, especially for refugee communities who stay in overcrowded environments. They have very low immune system. They often, you know, don't eat proper and regular meals. So being able to support in terms of nutrition would be really helpful in such a time as this.
That was Heidi Kwa, founder and director at Refuge for the Refugees, explaining how the refugee community was coping with COVID-19 when the lockdown first happened in March. We'll be right back. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Hezril. We'll be spending the hour looking back at what 2020 has brought for human rights. And we have to warn you, it's been bleak to say the least.
Yeah, and this year we've seen negative sentiments being expressed towards the refugee community. In April, for instance, immigrants working at the Selangor wholesale market were blamed on social media for the COVID-19 cases that were reported in the surrounding area.
And when this happened, we spoke to Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, co-founder of Yayasan Chowkit, to get her thoughts on these unwarranted reactions from the Malaysian public.
What do I think about it? I think it's appalling. I think it is so unlike the Malaysians I know, who are usually generous and caring and giving. I think it's so unusual and horrifying in that it is the Ramadan month. And it's supposed to be a time for reflection and forgiveness and caring and doing good. So this onslaught of hate and vile words and actions, not so much, but words, is just so... I don't understand. I don't understand how we cyberbully people who have so little, and we also cyberbully those who defend refugees and migrants. Ridiculous.
There are people on social media who've claimed things like, I quote unquote, I've worked with them, and I know that this group of refugees are just more prone than others to bad behavior and so on. What's your experience been like, given that you too work with migrants and refugees?
There are always going to be experiences with people that are not so nice. But I think it's really, really wrong to sort of tar an entire race and community based on one's personal experience. Just as you would in anybody, nobody goes around and says, Malaysians are like this or Americans are like this, just based on one encounter or one group of people. You can't form your opinion about a whole race or a whole group of people just based on one bad experience you have or one thing. It's about mankind. It's about humanity. It's about people. And like any other group, like any other community, like any other race, there are good people and there are bad people. So in my opinion, yes, I will meet someone who is rude, someone who, smells because he hasn't had a bath in 4 days. And I'll have children who don't know how to sit still because they've never entered a classroom, they've never sat down in a chair in a classroom. So you need to put yourself in that shoes, in the person's shoes, and ask yourself why this is happening, not just simply make stereotypes and judgments based on your personal experience. It's not about a race. It's about your personal experience with a person, not a race or group.
Right. And just on that, how's the situation on the ground in terms of how migrants and refugees, their experience with the pandemic as well as the NCO?
But they're terrified. If we're talking about refugees and migrants who are stuck at home because, they're afraid their documents aren't enough or sufficient, or because, they have no more jobs, so they can't even get transportation and they're walking and they're getting caught in the West Coast, they're terrified. We have pregnant mothers, refugees and otherwise, Malaysians, non-Malaysians, everybody who's pregnant, a pregnant mother who now, cannot go to the hospital, whose husband or families cannot afford to pay their hospital bills. And they're about to give birth, yeah? And so, you know, we need to arrange with volunteers to someone to pay the bill, someone to give the baby box, someone to go with them to interpret, to do the interpretation. We have people with no food. I had a family yesterday of 8 people, of which half were children, all under the age of 14. And the youngest was one who had no milk. And the mother was giving warm water for a whole day because there was no food. Are you telling us not to care because you don't like Rohingya refugees or migrants or anyone who's different from you? Because this is really what it's about, right? It's about you not liking anyone who's different or non-Malaysian, but you never care about the fact that they're human beings and there are children who are going hungry.
Right, so yeah. At the start of the conversation, you brought up social media and that you had to comment on one post that was very xenophobic.
Yeah, every day.
Right.
Every day, 4 or 5 posts.
And I'm sure it's one of the posts that you've seen as well that, you know, there's this sentiment that the government should perhaps save its resources to focus only on Malaysians and therefore we aren't able to welcome refugees. That the pie is actually very small because, well, even locally, not enough has gone around. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, thank God the government isn't listening, right? I know that the government is actually sharing the resources and making sure that, you know, non-Malaysians have food and stuff. I know it's delayed and I know that, you know, in some places they haven't eaten in a couple of days, but they've allowed the NGOs to go in and sort of distribute the food as long as they're with someone who represents the government or whether they're from, you know, JKM or another official person. But the problem isn't so much in Klang Valley. I think the problem is also outside of Klang Valley, where, you know, there are many migrants and refugees scattered throughout the state or outside of the cities and stuff. And that's where the bigger NGOs like Malaysian Red Crescent and Mercy Malaysia and all come in and distribute the food. And, you know, and as long as I think we've negotiated with the welfare officer and the Ministry of Women to allow, you know, trusted NGOs to go in with JKM officers and stuff to distribute food. What do I say to people who say don't give non-Malaysians? Why? They're a human being and this is about humanity. This is about compassion. This is about empathy. Where's yours? Why would you ever say that? How could you deny a child's milk or a child food? Why would you do that? I don't understand. It's beyond my comprehension. So I wish I could answer on behalf of them, but it's so beyond me, I cannot answer. Sorry, I don't get it.
Now, with emotions running high at the moment, how do you think, you know, we can move the conversation forward in a way that's productive and responsible?
Well, what I try to do, and this is just personal, this is not something that I think we've worked out as a group or as a movement, to combat xenophobia and misinformation. But what I've done is I've actually gone through some of the posts which are very anti-refugee and migrants and very xenophobic, and I've sort of picked the facts that they're sort of spreading and trying to combat it one by one. So one of the things that I saw on these posts was the idea that that the refugees, Rohingya refugees who came by boat, deliberately you know, came here, but they were trafficked. And there's this whole misinformation about the difference between smuggling and trafficking. And, you know, nobody puts themselves on a boat thinking that, you know, that it's going to be worse. They put themselves on the boat and they put their children on the boat because they think that their lives are going to be better somewhere else. Okay, and people die in these waters, right? The smugglers have their heart's content, I think, in being able to sort of exploit migrants who smuggle themselves on board boats, okay, these refugees and migrants, you know, sell everything they possibly have to get on these one of these rickety boats. And we're talking about 200, 300 people on a boat, yeah, smuggle themselves into these boats to try to come to a better future, they think, and then get exploited and trafficked on the boat. So, you know, it's not a matter of choice that what happens to them on the boat or that they come here, because when they come here, it's no better. They get detained, they get put in detention centers, they get accused, I have children getting spat on. You know, it's not a better life for them, right? They think it is and it's not. But there's this whole misconception of what smuggling is, which involves you know, yes, allowing yourself to get on that boat, but there's also the trafficking part, which is all the exploitation and the trickery and the selling. So, you know, what I try to do is to try to combat one thing at a time. The fact that they, you know, they hurl abuses and cyberbully my friends who defend Rohingya refugees. So I try to counter that and say exactly what kind of person is. How did she go wrong? What did she do wrong? You know, she did something wrong because she fed the poor. Are you serious? That's why. I saw somewhere, I was angry with you because you had free hair. And I'm like, what? That's why you got angry at her, because she had free hair. Nothing is logical. It's all emotional.
So you just heard Dr. Hartini Zainuddin, co-founder of Yayasan Chowkit, in a conversation that we had back in April, clearly sounding frustrated at the time by the growing negative sentiments against the refugee and migrant community in Malaysia. We're going to continue our look back on the year in human rights after the news. Keep it here on BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
All right. And now for a continuation of our conversation on what 2020 has been like for human rights. In July, Malaysia was in the spotlight when Al Jazeera published a documentary about the treatment of undocumented migrants during the MCO. They reported that 2,000 migrant workers were arrested during raids in red zones.
Yeah, and the government was really unhappy about this documentary. The Immigration Department, for instance, took action by looking for a Bangladeshi national who was interviewed in the documentary, expressing his concerns for a friend who had been detained.
So Immigration Director General Khairul Zaimi Daud announced plans to deport and blacklist the man for making negative remarks against Malaysia. Here is a replay of our chat with constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu about whether this was legal.
A foreign national may hold either a pass or a permit, both of which can be cancelled by the DG. Taking into account different considerations, the DG may at any time in his absolute discretion cancel a pass. The DG also may at any time cancel a permit, only if he is satisfied that the presence or the entry of the permit holder would be prejudicial to public order, public security, public health or morality in Malaysia. I think it was reported to have said that passes of foreigners who make statements which are considered detrimental to the nation's image can be cancelled. I think there are a few things to note here. The first is that, you know, there is no law that makes it an offence against making any statement detrimental to the nation's image. So in absence of such a law, anyone making such statements, even if it's distasteful or it is regrettable, would not be in breach of any laws. So if the removal is on such a basis, I do not think that the DG's decision can be considered reasonable, taking into account the overarching basic human rights principles of freedom of speech and expression that is enjoyed by all humans, regardless of their nationality and race.
In related news, refugee rights activist Heidi Kwa is being investigated by the police for a Facebook post about the alleged mistreatment of refugees in detention centers. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I can't say much because, I'm acting for her. But for me personally, I think the mere posting of a Facebook post that is critical of government cannot under any circumstances be considered a criminal offence. So it is a violation of one's basic freedom of speech and expression. It restricts citizens and individuals' participation in democracy by scrutinizing government and government officials.
Right, and on that note, are there laws, I guess, that allow for public scrutiny of government and its agencies?
Well, there are laws, but it's peppered in our fundamental rights, the freedom of speech and expression, the freedom to assemble peacefully, the freedom to associate, the right to equality and non-discrimination. These are all rights that upholds democracy and facilitates our exercise of our democratic right to check on the government when any one of these rights are violated or prevented from being exercised unreasonably, it affects democracy as a whole. So these are all basic principles which, you know, all laws must adhere to. And if any laws that are inconsistent with the federal constitution, it would be invalid, it would be void.
That was constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu talking about the legalities around the government's threat to deport a Bangladeshi man for speaking out against the treatment and discrimination of foreign workers in the country.
Yep, and the government also launched criminal investigations against Al Jazeera. So we spoke to Jabbar Sadiq of the Malaysian Insight to get his thoughts on what this means for media freedom in the country and whether it would have been the government's interest to respond differently.
I mean, the reality is, I think other countries will be looking at Malaysia and say, should we put money in Malaysia? Should we invest in Malaysia? Mm. And you have this kind of policies, you have this kind of crackdown. Very few investors will want to look at Malaysia. I mean, any country wants to look at Malaysia or any other country will say, hey, you know, you must have political stability, you must have some respect for human rights at least, and, you know, have a free and fair press. But if you keep putting down the media and you keep putting a knee to them, so to speak, you're not going to get that at all, right?
Hmm. So moving forward then, Jabbar, what impact might these investigations have on reporting in or about Malaysia?
Well, I think we just got to be a lot more careful. And I think any foreign news agencies coming to Malaysia should be mindful as to how sensitive the government can be about things. But also to engage the government straight on. You know, the last few days, Al Jazeera has been in the news for all the wrong reasons. It's one of the better regional news agencies that broadcasts around. But obviously, their 25-minute documentary was seen in poor taste. I finally went through it, all 25 minutes, and I thought, yeah, I can see concerns about its reportage. But I think every journalist who comes to Malaysia, who works in Malaysia, needs to take a wider view of also trying to ensure that they are fair to all sides of the debate, of the discussion, right? And sometimes we take it for granted that we can get away with things. But obviously, in Southeast Asia, you can't get away with a lot of things. Really. I mean, countries like Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, Philippines, they're getting away quickly. And then knocking on people's doors and questioning why they are saying things in a certain way. You know, it's just not journalists, it's activists, it's anyone else. But our only task, really, our only duty is to the truth and the facts that matter, right? So as long as we report the truth, the facts as it stands, I don't think we need to conform or change the way we report. We've always done the same thing, no matter which government is in power. People need to be informed.
You just heard Jahaba Sadiq, editor of the Malaysian Insight, commenting on the clamping down of media freedom in the country, following on from the fallout of Al Jazeera's documentary, Locked Up in Malaysia's Lockdown. We'll be back in just a bit. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Hezril, and we've been reviewing 2020 in relation to human rights. And just, we're edging along now towards catching up to where we find ourselves in December. So last month, we actually looked at a very troubling headline, which was the detention of migrant and refugee children.
Yeah, so back then, the Home Ministry confirmed that there were 756 being detained in immigration detention centres. They were mainly children of asylum seekers, many of whom were from Myanmar. 405 were unaccompanied by their parents or guardians. And here's Heidi Kwa again describing the situation to us.
Kids below the age of 12 are usually placed with either parent or guardian, you know, if they came in with one. And most of the time it's with, you know, the mothers or the women guardian at the women facilities building. However, once they turn 13, they usually move to adult facilities based on their gender. And this only means one thing, right? You know, when you get moved to an adult facility, you get treated like adult. So there's been reports even stating that these children are not detained with their family members, even in adult facilities, but rather with strangers. So I think it's really concerning because, you know, imagine you're a kid being surrounded by random men or women in a cell. that you don't know. And I think what's extremely concerning as well is that a lot of these dependent facilities are not equipped to house children. So some of them, you know, we've been told that have a basic nursery. You know, those kind of nurseries with like a tiny plastic playground. But that's really about it, right? And based on stories that, you know, I've been told by detainees that we've worked with over the years, a lot of times they are often locked up in cells without access to recreational space, educational facilities, and even adequate health care.
And I suppose we do need to ask, how does detention like this affect children?
I guess a lot of many studies have shown that separating children from their parents or guardians over a prolonged period of time can trigger extreme stress responses on the body, which results in additional impact on their health and development. There's been countless studies across the globe, you know, that have shown resounding findings, which imply severe long-term effects on a child's physical, mental, and social well-being and developmental health when detained. It's been shown that those with significant trauma exposure prior to detention experience greater risk of these effects. And as we know, a lot of these children detained are refugees and asylum seekers who have come from war-torn countries who have already experienced severe trauma in that sense, right? So with all these findings accumulated, you know, one can only imagine the anguish and agony the children are currently experiencing in detention centres where they have been penalised for seeking a safe space.
So in your conversations with affected families, what thoughts and feelings have they shared on children being detained?
Yeah, so we often work very closely with families who have, you know, family members detained, you know, or detainees that have came out of detention centres. A lot of them are extremely afraid. You know, many, you know, since being detained, don't even dare leave their house at its And they only leave, you know, when it's absolutely necessary. We've met kids and families who've been detained. And to today, many of them still suffer from severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, recounting their experiences in detention facilities. You know, sometimes, you know, I get calls at 3, 4 a.m. In the morning because they get nightmares, you know, of their time in detention centers. These nightmares are not just, you know, nightmares that you can shrug off and go back to sleep, but this PTSD impacts them in very severe ways. It's crazy because, you know, over the years, I've seen complete grown adults break down just recounting their experiences in detention centres. And these are grown men, you know, in their 40s, in their 50s. And sometimes, you know, it is even receiving calls, you know, from my students telling me that, like, my mother went out for work today and she got detained, you know. What can you do about it? And honestly, we can try to work, you know, with UNHCR and different parties to get them out, but it is an extremely long process, you know. And a lot of times these children have to go for months without even seeing their parents.
So have you spoken to immigration officers as well, and how do they feel about the issue?
Yeah, so recently, I had the privilege of working a little bit more closer with some immigration officers because the organization has been bringing supplies into detention centers, just basic essentials because of the rise of COVID cases within there, right? And I would think that, I mean, from our interactions, that they are actually, they find, they want to help, right? They know that what's happening is not okay inside, but yet they feel that their hands are tight, and there's only so much they can do because they're really just, you know, the middleman in all of this. You know, on one hand they have to do their jobs, on the other hand, you know, they have firsthand experiences, you know, watching the impacts of detention on children and on other people as well.
And how then do those officers relate to the detainees, especially the children?
I do think that a lot of times these officers are, I mean, they too don't think that children should be in detention centres. I mean, many of them have kids, right? So they are actively trying to find ways to, I don't know, maybe improve situation in detention centres based on what they can control. This means, you know, maybe access, a bit more access to milk powder. You know, that's why they partner up with organisations like us to bring in supplies, you know. Or, you know, we've recently been allowed to bring in a bit more toys, you know, because these kids are actually deprived from things that children should have access to. So I do feel that they are trying, but again, they are in a very difficult position.
And does the pandemic further complicate the situation?
Yeah, I would think that, you know, it has definitely very much further complicated the situation, right? I mean, from an increase of numbers in detention centers, not just COVID numbers, right, but new people being, you know, put in detention centers every single day, you know, and this is on a daily basis, you know, to the rise in COVID cases, leading to be more difficult for those who have served their time in detention centers to be released, because it's a long process, right? All these detention centers now have very high COVID cases. Yeah. So I feel that it has definitely, you know, further complicated the situation. It's made it a lot harder for NGOs and parties involved to also negotiate the release of children in detention, because, you know, now you have to think about the spread of the pandemic. Now you have to think of, you know, the COVID cases. Yeah, so it's made it extremely hard, you know, and it's also very concerning because, you know, with these young kids in detention centers, a lot of times the immune systems are compromised, right? Given the health pandemic, a lot of them are more susceptible to picking up different, you know, diseases. And how do we even protect young kids from that when they don't have very strong immune systems?
So to your knowledge then, what are some past and ongoing efforts which aim to improve living conditions?
Yeah, so back in 2018, the then Deputy Minister, Dr. Wan Aziza, confirmed that the Women's Ministry and Home Ministry, led by Muhyiddin, was going to execute a pilot project to move hundreds of children out of detention centres into NGO shelters. So that has not quite taken off yet because of everything that has happened this year. But that was one of the things that, you know, that was actively being worked on, not just by the Women's Ministry and the Home Ministry, but as well as in partnership with quite a number of NGOs as well as SLAKAM.
And would you know if there has been progress when it comes to developing alternatives to detention for children?
Not quite in Malaysia. So we still have not progressed much in developing alternatives to detention for children. But I think for me, it's always really helpful to look at what other countries are doing. And one of it would be the Indonesian government, right? For instance, children are now placed in community housing instead of detention centers. You know, when we look at Japan, you know, Japan no longer detains children, refugees or asylum seekers. But in fact, the government will try its very best to not detain these children by looking for people who care for them. So yeah, there are other countries that have been actively looking into developing alternatives to children in detention, but not quite Malaysia as yet. We do, I mean, I believe that NGOs and, you know, respective parties like SLAKAM and the UNHCR are doing their utmost best, but there are so many limitations in place. And that's why I think what's really helpful now is that every time a child refugee or an asylum seeker gets detained, UNHCR prioritizes speeding up the process of registration for the children, if they are a person of concern, just so that they can negotiate their release in that sense. Children should not be criminalized for immigration offences, and they shouldn't be penalized for crimes beyond their control, you know, which is seeking safety in a country, you know, after having plea, war and persecution. I think we all need to remember to be an embodiment of compassion, empathy and kindness, especially when it comes to children. We should not normalize trauma, pain and suffering for these children who've already seen and experienced more than any child should.
That was a replay of our conversation with Heidi Kwa, founder and director at Refuge for the Refugees, discussing the conditions and experiences for children being detained in immigration detention centres.
And that pretty much brings us to the end of our look back on the year that was, that has been for human rights. And having said that, those were just some of the issues that we covered, and it's by no means a full picture of what the year has been like.
Yeah, and also just to look ahead slightly, right? I mean, as we mentioned earlier, the waves of COVID-19 infections happening among the foreign and migrant worker communities have really, I think, put a spotlight on the long-standing issues surrounding our country's treatment of migrant workers. And I think this is something that we're definitely going to continue focusing on in 2021.
Yep. And in the meantime, you know, our question to you is, do you think that COVID-19 will be the catalyst for reforms in human rights? What would you hope to see change in 2021? Let us know by WhatsApping 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.